In 2000, the American negotiators asked to meet with me at the King David and said, we're about to start final status talks negotiations on Jerusalem. We don't know very much about the subject. Could you give us bar mitzvah lessons? And gulping, coming up for air, I said, excuse me, am I the only superpower in the world, or are you the only superpower in the world? Which is snarky about them, but actually I should be snarky about myself. I didn't have a ready answer. I had participated in all of the Track 2 stuff, and I didn't have a ready answer. I think today, with all of the humility of an Israeli, I know what permanent status looks like in Jerusalem with a fair degree of resolution. There are still a couple of big questions that have to be answered, which could go both ways, but that is a result of having been a very close kibitzer to all of the formal negotiations, Camp David, Taba, Olmert, virtually all of the Track 2 stuff, and understanding what under non-utopian circumstances will ultimately be acceptable to Israelis and acceptable to Palestinians. And that breaks down to some very, you know, clear principles. You know, all of the Israeli settlement neighborhoods in East Jerusalem will become Israel proper in the framework of a land swap. That's about 195,000 people. All of the Palestinians who live in Palestinian neighborhoods will live under Palestinian sovereignty. You know, you can have a land swap. We're not talking about a transformation of a transfer of population. The 2,200 settlers who live in existing Palestinian neighborhoods will have to be extracted. They're not going to be remaining as a detonator. Silwan, Silwan, Sheikh Jarrah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the price, and the price isn't going to be paid. I don't believe there'll be an agreement. Okay. And finally, you have to be able to draw a line on a map based on those principles, which will carve out a robust Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem while leaving intact a viable and contiguous Israeli capital, not only in West Jerusalem, but incorporating the Israeli settlement neighborhoods of East Jerusalem. That means you have to draw a line on the map that will allow every Israeli to go home at night without seeing a Palestinian policeman. And every Palestinian to go home at night and anywhere to Ramallah, Haram al-Sharif, or Bethlehem without encountering an Israeli policeman. That line is still possible today, but just barely.
Where is that line?
The Geneva line is of the Geneva Accords is an example. You know, I think that there are minor variations on it. But today, you know, put bluntly, watch the feet. Where Israelis walk today will be Israel. Where Palestinians walk today is already Palestine in some ways, will be Palestine. That solves 95% of the border regime. Where both walk, like the old city and its environs, you need some heavy lifting. And that's another subject. We won't get into that now. Okay? Now, my message is, what we've done in this presentation is the following. Let me give you a summary of previous episodes, sort of like a TV series. In 2008 and 2009, there was a large surge in settlement activities, higher than in recent years. Olmert got away with it, Netanyahu didn't. Olmert got away with it because there was a Republican in the White House, and he got away with it because he was negotiating in earnest with Abu Mazen. Netanyahu didn't get away with it because he wasn't negotiating, and there was a new Democrat in the White House. And for at least the first part of Obama's term, Netanyahu sort of reminded me of the Japanese soldier who came out of the cave in 1973 and hadn't been told the war was over. He was speaking to Elliot Abrams, but Elliot was gone. Okay, he was talking to Obama, and they don't speak the same English. Then came the Biden visit, March 9th, 2010, a year, you know, almost 2 years ago. 1,600 new units were announced, and henny-penny, the sky caved in. A week, 10 days later, Netanyahu had what I called an existential encounter with the president in the White House. And for a seven-month period, without anybody talking about it, there was a full-stop settlement freeze in Jerusalem. It wasn't announced, but it was there. There were no new tensions. We have objective benchmarks. This is not about glints in eyes. You know, are there plans that have been approved, deposited for public review, new construction in Palestinian neighborhoods, or part of the tender process? And it stopped. And by the way,
it was not a part of the moratorium.
It was an informal part of the moratorium. Okay. Now, this was not a change of heart. This was not Netanyahu being a Saul of Tarsus, having an enlightenment on the road to Damascus. It was another Christian symbol. It was all fear and trembling. This was Kierkegaard. Fear and trembling. He was afraid of the consequences that would be exacted by Obama, and when that fear dissipated in November, he was Bibi the recidivist and went back to his old ways, and the previous levels resumed.
If Obama, I can't say anybody's name, if Obama had continued a sort of vague stick, there would have been...
Look, one of the things that we can learn from this is Netanyahu cannot say, I can't freeze settlements. We now have scientific proof. He did. Proof. He did. Now, Netanyahu is delighted when I criticize him publicly, when I say, hey, he froze settlements. They hate me for that because, he can't say it will bring down my coalition. His coalition was at the peak of its stability while he was freezing settlements. And yes, the answer is, for all of the suspension of the laws of gravity when it comes to Israel-Palestine, Israelis not being an Israeli prime minister not being accountable for violating American foreign policy principles, or somebody says that settlements are like ice; they expand when frozen. You can pay lip service to the two-state solution and simultaneously destroy it with impunity. Had there been presidential engagement, I believe this could be different from that period.
And do you think that was sparked by Biden's visit and the sort of opprobrium and all the
No doubt. I don't think. I know. Since August, we are now at a level, and that annually, that is 50 to 200% higher than the previously high years of 2008 and 2009. We have not witnessed such a surge in settlement activity since the early 1970s when they were building Gilo and Neve Yaakov, etc. That surge. Now we have such a command of what's happening. We decided to engage and say, okay, let's project what the map of Jerusalem will look like at the end of 2013. And that's the last presentation that we've done. And it took me a long time to do this, not because we had to gather the information, because it's so easy to do this demagogically. To say that every random plan is going to be the death of the two-state solution and stuff like that. There are a lot of hidden agendas here. And I wanted to do something that would be empirically unassailable. So we arrived at the following criteria. Said, okay, let's ignore the minor plans. We're not going to be looking for a magnifying glass with a magnifying glass for bad behavior. We're talking about plans that have more than 100 units. Okay. Two, we're looking at plans that are in an advanced statutory stage, having been approved for public review, the penultimate stop before approval, after which the tenders can take place. Three, ignore plans that, even if they've been approved for public review, that appear to be dormant. Nobody's been acting on them over the last couple of years. And just isolate those plans. And we know what the timeline is. Things are going through. At the end of 2013, what we discovered was you will have under construction or with occupancy an additional 13,000 units in East Jerusalem, 25% increase in the number of residential units built since 1967.
What's the percentage?
A 25% increase. There are 52,000 units, and there would be 13,000. And here I am bending over backwards to be conservative, a 15% increase in the footprint, the built-up areas, territorial base of the settlements, 23% increase in the number of Israeli residents living in the settlement neighborhoods. I'll come back in a minute to the footprint, but it's more than that. And we have the maps on the website. This isn't, I would say, there are things that are detrimental to the two-state solution. There are also things that I believe are going to be virtually fatal to the two-state solution. You are having the string of expansion along the southern flank of Jerusalem. Gilo, Givat HaMatos, which does not exist as a neighborhood. There are a number of prefabricated housing there, carry over from the Ethiopian immigration, but no neighborhood. And the expansion of Har Choma into Har Choma B and C, you are creating an effective cordon or buffer between Bethlehem and East Jerusalem. And more importantly, Beit Tzafafa, with its 12,000 residents, today could be incorporated into a Palestinian state under the criteria that I said. For example, Geneva would be, under the Geneva Accords, Beit Tzafafa is Palestine. That would no longer be possible. It will be impossible. Now, this is without the construction of E1. E1 is not being built. There are indications that it's being considered seriously. We mention this, but these estimates that I've been giving you, E1 is clearly the fatal heart attack of the two-state solution for reasons that we go through why? Because of its location, it would do two things.
How do you spell it?
E1. E1 is the settlement neighborhood between Ma'aleh Edomim and Jerusalem, which would make the built-up area of Ma'aleh Edomim continue to East Jerusalem. And what that would effectively do, it would seal East Jerusalem from its environs in the West Bank, under the correct assumption that in the absence of a geographical connection, there would be no political connection. And because of the topography, it would create a buffer that would extend West Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, E1, Ma'aleh, Dumim, almost to Jericho. It would dismember the Palestinian state into a northern canton and a southern canton. Sharon started to build E1, and even the Bush administration read him the Riot Act, and it stopped. Netanyahu has not resumed it, but under circumstances that you might want to ask about later, that could happen. All of our appraisals are without E1. So why is this so problematic? I believe that this will make, even without E1, the two-state solution will be inordinately more difficult, if not impossible, because of the cumulative geographic and demographic balkanization of the map above Jerusalem. Now, if you come to me and tell me you don't believe a two-state solution is possible, you don't believe that a political agreement is possible, I'll disagree with you vehemently. But you can make a very compelling argument. If, on the other hand, you come and say it's possible for there to be a political agreement, but Jerusalem's going to remain undivided, I'm going to ask you what you're smoking. Okay. Secondly, you can't negotiate borders and simultaneously create the borders. It's just not going to work. There's a lovely a Greek fellow who dabbles in the Middle East, now lives in California, who put it most succinctly to me. He said, two guys order a pizza, and the pizza comes, and they're arguing who gets the mushrooms and who gets the olives. But during the negotiations, one guy can eat the pizza. Can't conduct negotiations that way. It just doesn't work. Three, and this is something that I'm saying with a great deal of hesitation because we haven't really looked at it enough. There are going to be another 3 square kilometers that are going to have to be included in the land swap. And that's a big deal. The Palestinians are offering 1.9, 2.3% land swap. Omer came down to 5 or 6 or 7%. It'll probably come to a state of rest somewhere around 4%. Now, the people who follow settlements naturally look at settlement expansion. What they're not looking at is, what about the bank of available lands for a land swap? They're also disappearing. because Israel is acting within total authority, is developing lands that are the lands that are candidate to be included in the land swap. So it's not only that the size of the land swap is increasing, the size of the lands available for the land swap is decreasing. And finally, even those plans that are not in and of themselves fatal to the two-state solution, I treat the creation of a border regime in Jerusalem seriously. If you weld an Israeli neighborhood to a Palestinian neighborhood by you know, narrowing the distance, you make the creation of that border more difficult and disclose you're not serious about creating a border there. So for all of these reasons, I believe that by the end of 2013, the two-state solution will be virtually impossible. I say the word virtually because when I talk about the possibility of the two-state solution, I am talking about the creating the two-state solution in circumstances that will neither be utopian, which will never happen, or cataclysmic, which might, but I don't want it. Okay, but under routine, even routine optimal circumstances, it will no longer be there. Now, I've never said that before. I've come to this town for 20 years, and for the last 11 years, when I see the old negotiators, their first question to me is, Danny, is it still there? Now, that's speaking in code. Mm-hmm. For them, it is the possibility of a political division Jerusalem still possible today? And until this year, my answer has, yeah, things are terrible. I don't like the way they're going. But no, the sky has not fallen in. I still know. Now, Har Choma, with its 12,000 residents, wasn't there in 2000. It is there today. It is a red flag for the Palestinians. They're insisting that it be transferred to them. The Geneva people agreed with that. But being blunt with you, I know how to connect Har Choma to Israeli Jerusalem in ways that will not destroy the possibility of a viable Palestinian, contiguous Palestinian city. I won't be able to say that a year and a half or 2 years from now. And that is entirely new. There is an additional thing that is entirely new. And that is, in the 20 years that I have been doing this, I have never seen such a depletion of energy, of lack of willingness to engage, coming from Washington. I don't purport on being an enormous success in keeping the two-state solution alive. I'm a cancer surgeon with a 20 or 30% success rate. But even when I failed, I was able to prolong life by getting folks in Washington to engage and get events in Jerusalem under control, slow things down, and things of that nature. The story that I told you at the beginning about Netanyahu acting as the Republican senator from Israel, he has said in word and in deed, Mr. President, you've got no leverage over me. Don't even try. Netanyahu has signified in word and in deed, I can do whatever I want with impunity, and I have opened the floodgates, and there isn't a damn thing you can or are going to do about it. Using the blunt Israeli phrase, maybe you can clean this up sufficiently so that you can make use of it. Everybody pisses in the swimming pool, but not everybody does it from the diving board. Netanyahu is doing it from the diving board, and the administration is saying, hey, it's raining. Which means that my predictions are based on the current trends. Were the brakes to be applied, hard or even softer, my predictions would be adjusted accordingly. But at the very least, all indications are that this calculus is not going to change at the very earliest until after the November elections. And I'm telling folks here, and they don't disagree with me, they dislike me because it leads them to conclusions that they have trouble living with. By the time you revisit this conflict, if and when there's going to be a second term, or if you have a new president, there may not be much left to talking about, and certainly by mid-2013, 2013 and to end 2013, and even if you begin on day one after the inauguration or after the election, depending on who's elected, you're not going to have the luxury of a gradual finessed re-engagement if you want to keep this pathetically ill patient called the two-state solution alive. So our goal here is to get to find the sources of energy to apply the brakes to keep the two-state solution on a heart-lung machine until circumstances will allow for a robust re-engagement. That's it in a nutshell.